In 1938, Mercedes-Benz began production of the largest, most luxurious limousine in the world. 20 feet long, upholstered in glove leather and bulletproof, the 770K was a lavish monster with a monstrous patron, Adolf Hitler and the Nazi Party. Most of the 770Ks didn't make it out of World War II, but several of them did, two finding their way to the United States, both of which still exist today. In the new book, The Devil's Mercedes, The Bizarre and Disturbing Adventures of Hitler's Limousine in America, author Robert Clara chases down one of the most improbable stories of the post-war era, the national drama that erupted when Hitler's armored limousine surfaced in the U.S., and uncovers the story of how Americans responded to these relics of fascism on their soil. Again, the name of the book is The Devil's Mercedes, The Bizarre and Disturbing Adventures of Hitler's Limousine in America. And it's a pleasure to welcome Robert Clara to the roundtable this morning. Robert, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So at what point do you become interested in The Devil's Mercedes, in this limousine owned by Adolf Hitler?
Well, it started, I guess, about 3 years ago, although I had been aware of these cars longer than that. I had finished my book about the White House, and I was casting about for new ideas, and I wanted to write about a cursed object. I wanted to write about something that kind of freaked people out, that was passed from person to person. And basically, since the Hope Diamond was taken, I decided to look for something bigger. And then I struck on the idea of finding a cursed automobile. And if you're going to go looking for one of those, you really can't do much better than the one that Hitler owned.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about the car itself. This is a Mercedes-Benz. They began production in 1938, and it is a luxurious limousine. Tell us about the car, what ultimately the model was, and then how it came into the hands of Adolf Hitler.
Well, the car itself was formerly known as the 770K model W150 open touring wagon. It was, at the time, possibly the largest car in existence. And it was about 20 feet long, 7 feet wide, fully armored. It was able to drive over a landmine. It could survive machine gun fire. The windows in the thing were nearly 2 inches thick. And inside was it was absolutely massive. It could carry 8 people comfortably. It was fully upholstered in black glove leather. And Hitler had more than one of them. This car had been put into production by Mercedes on a special order basis. And basically, heads of state and, you know, various potentates had, you know, taken to it. They were really the only ones that could afford it. When Mercedes armored one of them for Hitler's chauffeur, it happened to be well-timed, at least for Hitler, because it was shortly after one of several assassination attempts on Hitler, and so he decided to start using this car exclusively. He had, as you would imagine, multiple garages full of cars, and as my book recounts, a few of these found their way to the United States in the days after World War II. I tell the story of two of them because they kind of intertwine nicely. And one of them came through a very, very unlikely trade in an export deal gone bad, and it came over as collateral, basically, to a businessman in Chicago who suddenly he had been waiting for a new car from Detroit after the war and found himself quite unexpectedly driving Hitler's car instead. The other one was brought over by the United States Army, which had captured it in Bavaria late in 1945. They put it on the road to sell war bonds. So for a period of time, Hitler's limousine was cruising up and down the East Coast, mm-hmm. paying for war debt from the United States.
Is either one of these vehicles the one that he used primarily with and armored and so forth?
Yes. The problem with the whole Hitler car mystique is there were many, many cars at the disposal of the Nazi hierarchy. Obviously, most of them didn't make it out of World War II. Some of them did, but proving the provenance is extraordinarily difficult. The cars were, you know, they often lost their license plates and records were destroyed. It's very, very difficult to prove that Hitler used any car. In this particular book, there is a case to be made for both of the cars that I write about. One of them, he wrote in only briefly because it was a gift of state to Field Marshal Mannerheim of Finland, which was a reluctant ally of Germany's in the war. And the other one, though, he used exclusively for about 2 years. So depending on how you want to define it, that was truly his automobile.
But it would take, as you point out in the book, 4 decades to really understand, and a lot of people involved, to figure out which one had the provenance and which one didn't.
Yes, absolutely. There is a gentleman, as it turned out, one of these cars, the one that the Army brought over, the Army really wasn't sure what it had. It knew that it had a Nazi vehicle, but that was about it. And it sold the car off in 1956. It had been sitting in a government warehouse for years. It was sold off in a surplus auction for a few thousand dollars, and it was bought by a collector in Canada who eventually gave it to the Canadian War Museum. And the museum wasn't sure, you know, who the car had belonged to either. They thought that it possibly was Goering's car, although it wasn't. And it was a very low-level librarian, an obscure little man named Ludwig Koch, who, you know, as these things turn out, was actually German-born and had escaped the Nazis himself. He was in the Hitler Youth and was nearly killed in the war. And this man undertook a remarkable research undertaking that took, I don't know, about a year and a half, close to 2 years, really. And he was able to demonstrate the link, and I mean definitively, with photographs and everything else. So if it were not for that man, I wouldn't have the proof that I have. And his story kind of becomes part of the car story. So I put him into the book. He's toward the end of it. He has an entire chapter.
Why, when they have the auction and it goes off and this is Hitler's limousine, who would want it in the sense of, given, as you said at the very beginning, this cursed object? So who wanted it, and what was the significance in having it?
Yeah, it's a very, very good question, because even to this day, one of the cars that I write about is in the hands of a collector out in California. And I had asked him this very question, why would you or anybody want to own this? There are kind of two answers to that. One is strictly from the automotive collector's point of view, it's a remarkable automobile. It was probably the most high-tech machine built at the time. The fact that it had a link to Hitler, and I don't say this to glorify Hitler in any sense, but it does accentuate the value of a collector car to have a backstory that notorious. So that's one thing. The other reason, especially going back decades, is that a lot of the owners wanted to, and in fact did, put the car on public tours. What's pleasing about that is, even though they did it in a carnival setting, which was a little distasteful, they were able to take the proceeds, or many of the proceeds, and donate them to charities. And the public seemed to respond very well to the idea of this symbol of fascism and genocide and racial hatred being deployed for a good cause. And so, in a sense, the car, despite its very, very dark, troubled background, was ultimately deployed for noble purposes.
Robert Clara is our guest on the roundtable. The name of the new book is The Devil's Mercedes: The Bizarre and Disturbing Adventures of Hitler's Limousine in America. You have a picture that's very striking in the book of Kirkland Gibson commissioning the Trailmobile Corporation to build this rig to carry the Mercedes to the carnivals and the fairs. Mm-hmm. And it says right on the side of it, Hitler's personal armored car nationwide tour.
Yes, yes. And Mr. Gibson was a remarkable man, a great collector. Unfortunately, the car that he and others put on tour was the one that turned out to have only a very fleeting link to Hitler. So the car was kind of oversold, but in fairness to him and those who came before and after him, there really wasn't a whole lot of proof. I mean, it's really an extraordinarily difficult amount of research to do. But that trailer, that picture is pretty amazing, and it gives a sense of, you know, how this car was interpreted in the immediate post-war years, because we have so many decades we were removed from World War II now. In the immediate post-war period, many people walking around had either fought in the war or certainly had a family member who had. The war was a very immediate experience for a lot of Americans, and the vast majority of them had only experienced the war through newsreels and newspaper stories. So when this car rolled through town, it was a very rare opportunity to come into literal physical contact with a relic from the war, and indeed, as it was advertised, something that had belonged to the most horrible man that the 20th century had produced and the man who had started the war. So the draw was, if perhaps distasteful in context, understandable too.
So it is hard for many to believe, and I did not know this certainly going into reading the book, and you wouldn't even, I don't think you would even think that Hitler's limousine would wind up in a war museum in Canada.
Yeah, it's a really unusual place for it, especially because the presence of the car there is technically at variance with the collecting mission of the museum, which is to preserve military artifacts from Canadian wars. Now, Canada sent many, many men over to fight in World War II. But they were not in Berchtesgaden, which was the region of Bavaria where many of these limousines turned up, and in fact the one that they have turned up. So they kind of came into possession of it almost by default because it was a donation. And the strange story there is that their attempt to deaccession it, they had a curator there who made this argument, so this thing has nothing to do with Canada, we shouldn't have it. The public outcry was tremendous. The members of the Canadian public were overwhelmingly in favor of the museum keeping the car, and it's there to this day.
So there it sits in Ottawa, and as you
yep.
point out in the book, many people come to that museum specifically to see that car.
Yeah, it's I mean, I'm only speculating here, but I assume that it's probably frustrating for the museum on some level because the Canadian War Museum is truly a world-class museum. I spent quite a bit of time up there. I saw everything they have on exhibit, and it is truly an astonishing place. So I feel bad, you know, I certainly don't want to talk about the car in a way that would reduce any of the amazing archival and exhibition work that they do there. But the fact remains is that the word has carried that Hitler's car is in there, and I spent a lot of time standing next to that car, several hours, in fact, just watching people respond to it, and it is still a draw to this day.
Well, it is funny, because when you go to the website for the museum, they don't shout it. It's not like they're selling T-shirts.
No, you have to look for it.
Yeah. I mean, there's a picture, but they won't really tell you what it is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I mean, my guess is that that's probably deliberative, possibly because they do have such an excellent collection of other artifacts. And also, you know, one must be careful with this kind of thing. There's a fine line between exhibiting something in a proper context and promoting it in a way that would be offensive to people. And that is a line that I think that museum walks very well. It's not a line that was walked very well in all chapters of the history of these cars in North America, but that also gave me material to write about.
How much research did you do with Mercedes, with the company itself?
I was very fortunate in one respect. There is a Mercedes expert, well, obviously several of them, but there's a gentleman by the name of Jan Malin, who is over in Sweden, who is probably, he's advanced in years now, but he is possibly the foremost living expert on Mercedes-Benz supercharged eight-cylinder automobiles of the 1930s and into the early 40s. That man has devoted literally decades of his life to indexing everything that you can possibly imagine in the Mercedes archives. And he has published two enormous volumes on his work. And I am extremely fortunate that that man has done the work that he has, because he obviously knows German and has combed through the old ledgers, the order ledgers at Mercedes headquarters. And I was able to use his tables and not have to spend weeks or perhaps months in Stuttgart puzzling my way through that. In that respect, I was entirely privileged to rely on that gentleman's earlier research.
We're talking about the new book, The Devil's Mercedes, The Bizarre and Disturbing Adventures of Hitler's Limousine in America. Robert Clara is our guest. He's the author of the book. It's published by St. Martin's Press. That car that is in the Canadian War Museum has sustained bullet damage.
Yes.
Which is visible, very clearly visible when you see the car.
One of the windows is shattered, and there are various other, I think there's 9 bullet holes in the car total.
How did that help in positively identifying it as the car?
Well, it was enormously helpful. At one point, that car had undergone a restoration when it first came, it rolled into Canada. It stopped in Toronto at an automobile garage there, and it was repainted, and it had some bodywork done, and the owner at that time made the decision not to replace the shattered glass on the car. Now, later, he said it was to retain authenticity. My feeling is that it may very well have been that he couldn't find 2-inch thick auto glass lying around to replace it with. But whatever the reason, that shattered pane, which is on the right front passenger window, it's a complete shatter, although it's the glass is still intact. It didn't fall out. When Ludwig Koch, the librarian at the Canadian War Museum, was doing his research in 1980, at one point along the months and months of work that he did, somebody sent him a photograph of a captured Mercedes-Benz that the 20th Armored Division had gotten its hands on at the end of 1945 and had repainted and was riding around in. And it had a shatter pattern on the window, and he was able to look at that photo, and it matched up perfectly with the car in the Canadian War Museum. And that is the kind of identification that you just simply cannot refute, because glass doesn't shatter exactly the same way twice.
So when Ludwig comes to this, and as a librarian at the museum and has worked for so long, and finally makes the positive identification, and this goes back to our earlier discussion about the museum and the reaction, is that a blessing or a curse?
You know, I've always felt that it's, are you asking me, was it a blessing or a curse for librarian Koch or for the museum?
I guess both, yeah.
I mean, I think, I guess in a way it was both, because, well, for Koch specifically, he never received much in the way of public credit for the work that he did. When the museum issued a press release that the car had been identified as Hitler's personal limousine, the press release only credited a former librarian. Koch had retired by that time. So he didn't even get his name in the papers, not that I found. He did publish some articles in some small automotive magazines, but he pretty much died without having been recognized. So I'm sure that that made him very frustrated. It certainly would have for me. That's one reason why I was happy to give him as much attention as I could, if only posthumously, in this book. As for the museum, I feel like it's always been a kind of blessing and curse for them, too, because the car is a big draw for people. I mean, it's a reason, certainly not the only reason, but a big reason why many people come. And yet, it's not an easy artifact to curate. I spoke to a retired curator there who told me of the many months that they spent painstakingly planning on how they would exhibit this car in a way that would be contextually sensitive. And also, there's still some, risk of people trying to damage the car. That has always been part of this car's story. Throughout its time in North America, there have been people that have wanted to blow it up and set it on fire and otherwise try to destroy it. So, you know, it does seem to bring out a range of responses in people across the spectrum.
When you have an item like this that is so cursed, is it possible to put a value on it?
You know, that's a question I knew I'd be asked, and I wish I had an answer. But, I mean, I'm sure that it would sell for something if it ever came up for sale, but the one in Canada I don't think will ever come up for sale. As to what it's valued at, I'm afraid I wasn't privy to their insurance documents, so I don't know. The other car that's in the book is in the hands of a private collector in California, a gentleman who is gracious enough to allow me to his home to look at the car. He has sunk 20 years of his time and resources into restoring that car, because restoring a 10,000-pound automobile that's fully armor-plated is not an easy job. He's quite a well-to-do gentleman, but I'm sure that it still cost him plenty. I have no idea. He did not tell me how much he spent on it, but I would not be surprised if it were the high six figures or well higher just on the restoration. If the thing were to go now, seeing as Duesenbergs go for several million,
yes,
there's no way that this car wouldn't go for several million now.
And just one other thing before we draw to a close, but at the Canadian War Museum, they're very careful, too, not to have any of the Nazi flags or any of the accoutrement that was on the vehicle when it was in use.
Right, right. Yes. The gentleman I spoke to who had worked on the way that the exhibit would be arranged, we talked about this for a long time. The challenge that they had is they wanted to show the car in context. It was obviously a tool of Nazi propaganda when Hitler used it. It was far more than a way for him to motor around. It was part of the pageantry and display that Goebbels had planned for the Nazi party rallies. And it still does its job. It is an intimidating, in a sense, beautiful, but I think very frightening-looking machine. The risk is that you don't want the thing to – you don't want people to walk away thinking, wow, what a cool car. So it's exhibited with a backdrop of one of the Nazi party rallies, and there are three swastika banners in the distance, just to remind people exactly where this car came from. But otherwise, the car is stripped down. It does not fly the swastika pennants that it would have when Hitler was using it. And I think that was actually a very smart thing that they did, because they don't want to beat people over the head with it. They don't want to do anything that would be interpreted as tacky. And also, the placards around the car are appropriately instructive. So I think that it's a balancing act that they did. I think they've done it well.
The name of the book is The Devil's Mercedes, The Bizarre and Disturbing Adventures of Hitler's Limousine in America. The book is fascinating, really interesting read. Robert Clara, thank you very much for spending time with us.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Again, the name of the book is The Devil's Mercedes. It is published by Thomas Dunn Books. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.